Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, November 14th, and I'm your host, Hera Santa Maria. Now, this week, in light of the recent American election, I have Jen Briney on the show. She's the host of the Congressional Dish podcast. So we're going to talk about the outcome of the election and what it may mean for the future. But before we jump into that, I want to get a little bit of business out of the way. First and foremost, I'm asking you guys a huge favor. Those of you who, you know, appreciate the show, who spend a lot of time listening to the show, or those of you who have just heard it for the first time, if you have an extra 5 minutes in your day, I would really appreciate it if you would visit my website, carasantamaria.com. There, I've just put up an audience survey. You can find it on the first page, or if you click through to the Talk Nerdy show, you can find it underneath the show notes of this very episode. That audience survey is going to help me serve you guys better. It's going to help me partner with better advertisers and know a little bit more about my audience so that we can be a little bit more tailored and targeted. So if you've got a few minutes and you're willing to do that, I would really, really appreciate it. Otherwise, I just want to remind you guys that there are a lot of ways to support the show. You can rate and review on iTunes. You can share it on social media. And if you're interested in supporting the show financially, you can visit my Patreon page at patreon.com/talknerdy. I want to thank my top patrons for the week, including Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Ron Kano Block, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, The Honorable Husband, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and last but certainly not least, Jeffrey Sewell. All right, guys, I think that's it for business at the top of the show. So yeah, why don't we just dive right in? This episode is really important, obviously. This is something that has been on everyone's mind, not just here in the States. I've been expressing my opinions via social media, but I've also been trying to stay kind of as positive and hopeful as possible. Ultimately, I do have some problems with the not my president rhetoric, although I did not vote for Donald Trump. And I don't think many of my kind of science, pro-science listenership did. Some of you may have, you know, I can't venture to know what happened in the ballot booth. But whether you voted for him or not, and whether it turns out that he ultimately didn't win the popular vote, the margin was relatively small. And he did take the Electoral College. And although many of us have issues with the way that voting happens here in the States, we are going to talk about that on the show. He won. He won the election. And the Republicans won the House and the Republicans won the Senate. And this is the truth now. And I think that pretending like it didn't happen, being incredibly cynical, bemoaning what may or may not happen in the future is just simply not constructive. So I have the position and the opinion that we want this person, this president-elect, to do as good a job as he absolutely can. We want to hold his feet to the fire. We want to ensure that as the executor of this country that he's representing as many people as possible, we want him to unify. And although some of his rhetoric does not, much of his rhetoric does not point to that being the case, it doesn't point to the future holding that as the case, nothing has happened yet. We don't really know what's going to happen until it's all official. I say we deal with the problems as they come, we unify, we write to our leaders, you know, our elected leaders in the House and the Senate, and we work. This is the time for us to work. I think sometimes the best activism comes out of suppression. And the last thing I want to see happen is that the young people in this country, the millennials in this country, the people who will be coming of voting age before the midterms and or before the next presidential election become disillusioned and don't come vote, because that really would be the biggest tragedy of all of this. Okay, soapbox over. I think at this point, why don't we bring on my guest? We have a lot to learn from her. She has so much insight. Her name is Jennifer Briney, and she is the host of the Congressional Dish podcast. So without any further ado, here's Jen. Jen, thank you so much for joining me today. It is an interesting week, to say the least. I am really glad that I have somebody who I trust that I can dig into these insane election results with.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk to you.
Yeah, for sure. So for anybody who doesn't know, I did an episode with you previously. I can't remember the episode number offhand, but it's been a while. You are the host of the Congressional Dish podcast. So why don't you tell the listeners kind of what inspired you to start that podcast and what your goal is on the show?
Well, I started it about 4 years ago just because I realized that Congress was our branch. So as far as having a say in what happens in the federal government, I realized it was Congress and then realized my own ignorance as to what goes on there. And so I started from really knowing nothing. And so for the first 2 years of my podcast, I just read every bill that passed the House of Representatives and learned a lot about how it worked along the way. And now it's really morphed, or it's morphing. I mean, it's a work in progress. But really, my goal with this is to just raise awareness as to what's going on in Congress and our power to control it. And so what I'm trying to do right now is figure out how I'm going to tackle this new situation we find ourselves in with a Trump presidency with a full Republican Congress. I'm going to have to tackle this differently than I ever have.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have been living with a Republican House for quite a while. We had every expectation, I think, here in the States that the House would still go red, but we were hoping that we might be able to take the Senate. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. And so now we're looking at the next 2 years, at least, with a Republican president, or I don't even know if you want to call Trump a Republican. He's a very interesting character, but but ostensibly a Republican president, a Republican House of Representatives, and a Republican Senate, which means that the entire Congress is majority Republican, although it's pretty tight in the Senate. I mean, there still is a majority, which sucks, but there are quite a few Democrats in the Senate. And then I think what worries most of us, right, is the fact that we have an open seat on the Supreme Court. There's the potential for more open seats, and with basically full Republican control across all checks and balances, there's a good chance that we're going to end up seeing a very conservative judge be put in that seat. I think that worries most of us because all of these other things are up for re-election in 2 years or 4 years. Supreme Court justices have an appointment for life.
That's true. We just have to hope that the two that are on the court just hang on.
I know. Yeah, I saw a tweet. It was something like, never in history has like Ruth Bader Ginsburg's diet and exercise routine been the subject of such scrutiny. You know, this poor woman.
So true. And the like, keep going, girl.
I know. And the truth is there was talk of retirement, but I would assume that a progressive justice, knowing the political climate, hopefully, as much as it might be incredibly inconvenient, would wait to retire until there's a more stable system in place. So I guess, is that a good kind of background? I don't want to do a full civics lesson, but there are quite a few listeners to the show that aren't even American. Obviously, we have checks and balances, meaning that we have three different branches of government who do different things. We know we have the executive branch, which in many ways does have a lot of power, but also has a lot of like power of perception. We have the legislative branch, which, as you mentioned earlier, is really our branch. They represent the people and they are there to pass laws. And then we have the judiciary, which is there to kind of maybe not enforce laws, but to, what's the word I'm looking for?
They're basically the referees.
Yeah. So they interpret them if somebody feels like or thinks that something that happened, you know, somebody was arrested, there was criminal activity put forth unfairly that seems to be in breach of the Constitution, they will file suit and hopefully eventually it'll go through all the appellate courts to get up to the level of the Supreme Court. That's really what they're there for, is they're the highest ruler in the land to say, yes, this is legal or no, this is not legal, according to how we interpret the law. And those precedents have a lot of power. They stick, you know, and it takes a lot to overturn those precedents. And sometimes they're bad precedents, as most people think, except for a very small percentage of individuals with a lot of money and a lot of power. For example, Citizens United is a terrible precedent, both on the Republican and Democratic side. People are not happy with that. So that does happen sometimes. But for the most part, they uphold Roe v. Wade. They do like Brown versus Board of Education. These are important and incredible things that the Supreme Court has done. Okay, I'm done yammering. I want to talk about the election this go around, because it was a huge, I shouldn't say upset, because obviously many, many people were in support of Donald Trump. It was a huge, what's the word?
Surprise? It was a shock.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah. Shock. I'm in shock, because I guess I always kind of knew that this was a possibility, but my brain didn't quite go there. Mm-hmm. Even though I knew that Trump or Hillary were really our two options, and neither one of them I would have been happy with, it never occurred to me that we would have Trump and a full Republican Congress.
Yeah.
Like, that's the part that I'm dealing with, because what I was prepared for was a Hillary presidency and a Republican Congress, and really just a more center-right Obama administration, probably more wars, but there would be this divided government. What we're dealing with now is all of the bills that I've been reading for the past 4 years that could never get into law because Obama had the veto pen. Well, now Trump has the veto pen, and I read Trump's book to see what we were in for, and he really is a Republican. I mean, he agrees with the Republican Party on so much. And so a lot of the things that my listeners and myself found horrifying in these bills, like so many corporate favors and a devotion to fossil fuels, these things that just had this barrier, that barrier is now down. And so that's my biggest concern. I mean, Trump himself is not my biggest concern. It's the combination of the Congress plus Trump that I don't know what we're in for. I really don't.
Yeah, I could see that. You know, I think there's no question that Trump is obviously an anti-environmentalist president-elect. I think that nobody will be surprised when he does favor the coal companies and all of the fossil fuel industries. I guess there is hope still, and maybe it's naive hope in my heart, that a lot of his campaign promises that were very xenophobic, that were incredibly nativistic, divisive, I mean, I could say outwardly racist, were rhetoric to get elected. Because historically, when he had no, actually, I think he always has had government ambitions, but when he didn't have a toe in any sort of policy, he seemed to be more sort of socially liberal. He seemed to be more sort of for, you know, women's rights, and not overtly against, you know, equal rights for minorities. So this seems to be a more recent shift where he was playing into the hands of the constituency. The problem is the people that he's surrounding himself with, the people that he appears to be wanting to put in cabinet positions, are not going to challenge this kind of new Trumpism.
Yeah. And he has flip-flopped. And I think that's one of the things that's making people so afraid, is we don't know exactly what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. But what's also interesting here is that a lot of the things that people are projecting onto Trump, like he's going to do this and he's going to do that, a lot of it is, it's Congress that can do these things. So for instance, like the Affordable Care Act, there are limits to how much that can be dismantled. You know, we don't have a supermajority in the Senate. So the Democrats in the Senate can stop certain things. So the straight repeal of the Affordable Care Act, that's probably not going to happen. There's not going to be Democrats that are on board with that. So the way they're going to have to do this is with like budget gimmicks. So they can defund it. They can hurt the law, that's for sure. But like pre-existing conditions are probably not coming back. Lifetime limits are probably not coming back, at least not right now. So there are these separation of powers that most people in the United States don't understand. And so there's a lot of fear about the things that Trump can do that he just can't. Like immigration, he's our chief law enforcement officer, which is scary, but there needs to be new immigration laws to allow 11 million people to be up and like taken out of the country. That isn't the law yet. And there are people of color in the Congress on both sides of the aisle that aren't going to go down for this. And we also have to remember that the Republican Party itself is still fractured. So we're going to witness infighting. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that are freaking out on one side, like this is the worst thing ever, that I think are going to be pleasantly surprised when the whole country doesn't come crashing down. And then there's also people that are so elated right now that are going to be disappointed. I think we just need to find our bearings in the next few days and weeks and months that are coming up and realize that, you know, there's separations of powers here that are not going to allow all these promises to happen.
Yeah, so even though there's a simple majority in the House and the Senate now, what you're saying is that, for example, with the Affordable Care Act, you would need a supermajority within the Senate for this to be able to go through. They've tried to repeal Obamacare, God, like countless times.
So many times.
So many times, and it's never passed. And it's not that it didn't pass just because Obama kept vetoing it. It didn't pass because there's not enough Republicans in the Senate to allow it to pass.
Exactly. And the reason that that is the Senate has funky rules that really, they're very, very strange. But the way that this would work is that the Democrats are able to prevent bills from coming to the floor and even getting a vote. So that's why it's not necessarily that they don't have the votes to pass it, but if you don't have the 60 votes to get the bill onto the floor, then it can't move and it can't become law. So that's kind of the strategy behind it.
I kind of like that funky rule. It seems like it's a better protection than just a 51-49 over and over. You know what I mean?
It's coming in handy now, isn't it?
Yeah, because, I mean, we look at, let's say, obviously what's on most people's minds is the executive, is Donald Trump. And you look at the outcome of the election, there's a lot to say about the Electoral College here. He won the electors by a landslide, but actually Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by a very tight margin.
You know what's funny about that is the electors haven't actually been cast yet and won't be until mid-December. And I just did an episode on the Electoral College because I didn't know anything about it. And it turns out the electors are 538 human beings. These are party insiders. And so until that day, I mean, they're allowed to go off the rails and vote however they want to. So if in the next few weeks, Trump really is seeming like he's going off the rails, we don't know exactly how the electors are going to vote when they sit down. Our system for voting for president is completely insane. In fact, there were two electors from the state of Washington who said that no matter what, they would never cast a vote for Clinton, no matter what the voters said. So we haven't quite finished this election yet until the electors actually cast their votes. And we also have to remember that when it comes to the popular vote, that all the votes aren't counted yet either. So if you go on the Federal Election Commission's website, there's nothing. And so they're all projections. So the same stuff that happened with the polls, where everyone's guessing, they're still guessing. Until the Federal Election Commission says this is how many votes were counted, we still don't know if Hillary won the popular vote yet. People are guessing that she did. It's not necessarily true. But the main point is that December 19th is when Trump actually gets elected. It's still not a done deal.
Yeah, and there's a lot that could happen in between then. Like you said, all of the votes haven't been counted because we have a system where each state does it kind of the way that they do it. So it's not really mandated across the states. Also, for many places, there's, you know, absentee voting, there's vote by mail, where it only had to be postmarked by Election Day. So some of those, it's only as of the day that we're recording this, Friday, November 11th, which means like a lot of people's votes are still in the mail. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like they absolutely haven't been counted yet. And as you said, a lot could happen before the electors actually cast their votes. I mean, Trump is under he's under legal scrutiny right now. You know, he's facing I don't know if it's a criminal suit or a civil suit, is it a sexual harassment or is it a straight rape suit? I'm not sure, but he's facing some things that are like, don't look good in the eyes of the electorate. And granted, you said that the electors are party insiders. They're probably much more cynical than the standard American voter. They have, they're playing the game in a way that most individual voters don't, but they are still people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if we find stuff out about Trump, I mean, who knows what these people are going to decide? I mean, they might decide that not allowing him to become the president is the right thing to do. I mean, we have no idea. I mean, it's such a weird system that we have.
It's really weird. And it's not like he's not being brazen at this point. I will give him a lot of credit. I think that his acceptance speech after Hillary finally called him to concede was a breath of fresh air for me personally. I was ready for him to walk up and start gloating, and not in any sort. I'm not trying to be extreme about it. That's just was generally sort of his way. And so I was expecting him to come up and say, they said we wouldn't win and we did and we, despite the odds, but it was incredibly conciliatory. It was all about being unified. He had he was presidential. He thanked Hillary Clinton and it didn't feel forced. It felt like he was being quite genuine. Who knows if he was. Towards the end of his speech, you could tell he went off script because he just sounded like himself again. He didn't luckily didn't say anything crazy, but he did sort of just start talking out of his ass again. And everybody could point to that one moment where they're like, oh, there's Trump again. But in the meantime, he has broken precedent with keeping a press pool around him. Like, he's already started to announce his cabinet appointments, and a lot of people aren't very happy about, you know, a climate denier being the head of the EPA, about a young earth creationist being appointed Secretary of Education. These are scary things for a lot of people, even moderate Republicans.
Yeah. The thing is, though, we've been down this road before. I mean, during the George W. Bush administration, that's the same situation we had at the EPA. So some of this isn't new territory. But what is new is where Trump doesn't align with the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. So that's where I find some hope. I mean, the Republican Party has been in lockstep. Like, for instance, one of the things I'm excited about, genuinely excited about, is that TPP and TTIP and TISA, these giant trade agreements that give corporations the power to sue governments, they're dead. You know, they just stopped. And so there was this train that we were all on and didn't even realize it, where we were signing on to these agreements where we had absolutely no say and no participation in. And all of that has come to a screeching halt. I mean, for all intents and purposes, we just Brexited. And so for anyone who wanted change, I mean, the details are still to be determined, but change is coming. In one way or another, we're not going to be dealing with the same old, you know, corruption and the same people running this country. We're not going Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton. I mean, this is a change.
And it is a change, and we have no idea if it's for the good or for the bad, or for the better or for the worse. One thing that I think is interesting that you've just pointed out is that we want to sort of put Obama on this pedestal and say he was the most progressive president we've had in recent history. And in some respects he was, but in other respects he was so establishment. And there were decisions that were made by him and his administration that I think when you really dig deep were incredibly saddening to the pure progressives among us. And we may see a similar thing happening with Trump, with some of his sort of platform, it's almost like not in lockstep with what we think of as traditional conservative values. So we might see some things that actually are quite progressive coming out of the Trump administration simply because they're anti-establishment. But I think a lot of people who hope that he is going to be a champion for campaign finance reform, or that he's going to be a champion for small business and for the working middle class, may be in for an unpleasant surprise, because I don't think there's anything in his history that shows that he's not a total corporatist.
He is a multinational corporation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he
is. He's a walking, talking multinational corporation.
And he already appointed, you know, his children to his transit. This just happened today. I was reading that he's appointing three of his children to his transition team when they were supposed to be the individuals to take over the trust of his business. Like, that's a major conflict of interest. I honestly don't even know if it's legal, so that might get stopped. But he's already doing things that are like quite unsavory from the perspective of trying to keep his personal interests and his personal ability to make money separate from his office.
I just had like a small panic attack when you said that, because maybe it's not legal, but who's going to stop him?
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where we're like, yeah, that shouldn't be legal, but the laws are so complicated and there's so many loopholes. And we already know that this is a guy who, during a public debate, was like praising himself for taking advantage of IRS loopholes so that he didn't have to pay taxes. Like, when we finally found out that he actually didn't pay taxes for many, many years, he was like, yeah, that's because I'm smart.
Yeah, but you know what? Maybe we can see some hope in that, because one of the points that he made was like, well, I mean, I just know how to work around the laws as they are. If you want laws that make sense, you got to change the laws. But if you give me this loophole, I'm going to take it. Mm-hmm. So maybe he will want to close the loopholes. I mean, we have no
idea. Or maybe he'll
want to
help create more. I mean, that's always my biggest concern is that, and again, this is all speculation, but generally speaking, people are people, and it takes a very special type of person to make decisions that are outside of their own best interest for the cause of the greater good. I don't have a lot of faith that that's something that Donald Trump is putting first and foremost in his mind. But again, he's such a confusing character. You know, many people will say outward that he's a con artist, that he's a narcissist, that he's somebody who will do and say whatever it takes when it benefits him in the moment. We don't know that that's the case. I think there's some good evidence to support that. But the craziest thing about this election is that we have no earthly idea what's to come.
I know. But with a narcissist or just a human being, I don't think anyone wants to go down in history as being the worst president ever.
I think that's such a good point. The biggest thing about a narcissist is that they want a legacy. And you can't get a legacy, or at least you likely don't want a negative legacy. You don't want a Hitler legacy. You want a legacy that lives in history in a positive way.
Yeah. It's like I'm trying to approach this because it's out of our control now until 2018. Mm-hmm. Until we get to vote for Congress, I mean, we're really just spectators. And I hate to be like that, but it's true. And so as I'm spectating, it's like, how can we direct this in a way that is not all bad? And I just feel like looking for the things where we might agree with him on, like infrastructure. I think we actually have an opportunity here. Now, it'll probably be privatized infrastructure that's going to cost us a lot to use. But we might get some roads and bridges and trains and new buildings. I mean, Trump likes to build things.
Yeah, and I was really pleasantly surprised that that was like one of the first things he focused on in his acceptance speech. I do think that he's probably going to attempt to be an isolationist president. It really sounds like most of his vision is turned towards domestic policy. And I'm going to be honest, I think I would prefer a president who has no diplomatic experience and who has worrisome ideas about diplomacy to be a non-diplomatic president than to be a poorly diplomatic president. I would rather be an isolationist nation for the next 4 years than destroy a lot of relationships that we already have. That said, there is no controlling outside influence. If there is a war that breaks out, if there is a terrorist attack, the whole game has changed. We have no idea what's going to happen. I think Bush probably would have been an isolationist president also if 9/11 hadn't happened.
I mean, that's definitely a possibility. But what I do kind of like, and one of the things that, you know, both him and Bernie said things that were similar. And one of the lines that they were drawing that sounded similar was that we need to invest in ourselves and that we don't need to be ruling the world.
Yeah.
And I feel like the Clinton administration, she made no, I mean, I was amazed at how honest she was about the fact that we were going to go all in on Syria. I had watched a lot of State Department hearings where it was very clear that regime change was the goal and Russia is defending Syria. So it was a very dangerous thing that we were doing. And none of us really want to take over Syria. You know, we don't want to have terrorists, but at the same time, like, who are terrorists? We don't know who these people are that we're bombing. We really don't.
Yeah, and so we're treating it as if it's an institution that we can negotiate with or that we can take over the same way we've historically been able to. That's just not how these organizations are run anymore.
Yeah, and there are all these calculations, like we have to be involved in Ukraine and the Baltics, and it's all for this goal that appears to be to have this economic system that's run by the United States. And a lot of us aren't on board with that because I can tell you my potholes are pretty bad and I ride on BART here in San Francisco all the time. It's 1970s infrastructure and the next earthquake, some of it's coming down. So it's like, I want our money to stop going to these other countries for reasons that none of us really understand and start to invest in ourselves. And that was something that he's speaking to and immediately started talking about. So instead of focusing, I mean, obviously, we have to watch the things that we're worried about: healthcare, energy, immigration, privatization, the Supreme Court. Yes, we have to watch those. But there's opportunity here too. And so for the people that are panicking, I think we have to look at the opportunities and embrace those and try and get as much good out of this as we can, because what's the alternative?
I completely agree. You know, in the kind of hours and days following the decision, in all of my sort of personal and private channels with my closest friends and confidants, many of whom have similar careers or career aspirations as I do, science communication, many of them are freelance, work for themselves, some of them work for other organizations. And so we're on our Slack channels and we're, you know, texting each other and tweeting each other. And there was a real concern and a real kind of heartfelt conversation about, how do I navigate these waters? I'm in despair. I'm upset. I'm nervous. Do we talk about it publicly? Do I need to be careful about not showing my emotions outwardly to my fans and followers? Or is it something where we can work through it together? And I think the consensus among most of my friends who have a similar outlook as I do is, it's not that, like, the dumpster's not on fire yet, so why would we fan the flames? Like, it's very important to take a step back and to understand that the American tradition is a peaceful and seamless transition of power. This is a democratic process. There are problems with it, yes, like the Electoral College, which we talked about. Yet still, we are a representative democracy. And the truth of the matter is, Trump was elected fairly. And even though we don't agree, you know, maybe we, quote unquote, as a more sort of liberal, more sort of coastal city outlook, don't agree, the truth of the matter is he represents a lot of people. And we ultimately, don't we all hope that he does the best job that he possibly can? We're not rooting for failure, and we're not rooting for danger. We're not rooting for mass hysteria or collapse or difficulty. We're rooting for him to do the best job that he could possibly do and protect his citizens and be a president. So why would we fan these flames right now? It's a really dangerous and scary thing. And, you know, as the Obamas said, when they go low, we go high. It's super sad and scary to see some of the hate crimes that are being committed sort of in the name of this election right now. I ultimately don't blame Trump for that. I think that he exacerbated the problem because he did sort of embolden certain individuals who have always been there, but they've always been there. And I hope that we just set an example, law enforcement sets an example, and communities at large set an example, that when these hate crimes are happening throughout the country, that we double down and show that they will not be tolerated.
Yeah. Well, and I don't feel like Donald Trump has ever said that he's down with hate crimes. He said law and order. So I feel like I'm hoping that that goes for the crazy white people, too. I don't see why it wouldn't. In fact, I've heard, and this is just speculation, too, but I've heard Rudy Giuliani's name being thrown around for the attorney general, which I'm no fan of Rudy Giuliani, but New York is a pretty nice place. Like, I don't know. Like, there's.
But aren't you afraid of stop and frisk? Like, some of these sort of unconstitutional things. You know, it's so tough because we could sit here and parse out every single policy. He has so few policy platforms, you know, that we can actually point to all of them and discuss them, because we just don't really know what's coming. But at the same time, we also don't know how much of that was just rhetoric to get elected. I think more than any other time in my history, do I just think that most of what he said was lip service. Like, I really believe the words that Hillary Clinton said, because she has a long track record, and all of her kind of debate points were totally on message, the same message she's been on for decades. I feel like with Obama, the things that he said, I really believed, because his, you know, social work were sort of on message. It, there was no sort of contradicting himself. But with Trump, I have no idea if the things he said, he literally just said to get elected. I have no idea.
Well, there's a documentary that I haven't quite finished it, but there were some interesting clips on it. It's Frontline, and it was about Hillary and Trump. I think it aired about a month ago.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah, it's called The Choice. Everybody should watch it. It's free. It's PBS. It's Frontline. Look it up online. Anyway.
Yeah, even on your Apple TV. I mean, you don't even... Yeah, so I was watching that, and there are certain things that he has been consistent about, and one of them has always been trade, always. And I think a lot of people discounted how important that was to the people who did lose their job to the trade agreements. And, you know, Hillary's been consistent on some things. Trade isn't one of them. You know, she negotiated the TPP and then straight up lied to us when she said she was against it. It was always hedged with, I'm against it in its current form. She always added current form. And then you read the emails and, you know, there's just this distrust of someone who takes, she raised almost $500 million, most of that in large contributions from rich people. And it's like, that's the type of stuff that was making people sick. And on the Democratic side, I mean, when you look at, and obviously the numbers haven't completely come in, but Trump didn't get any more votes than Romney or McCain. In fact, I think he was either even or a little bit less. I'm looking at a graph in my head, but it was about even. But what changed is that Democrats, they voted for Obama in giant numbers, a little bit less in the last election, and they just didn't show up for Clinton. So this really, yeah. I feel like it was a crisis on the Democratic Party side. And then there's a huge story in that about half of the people that could vote just didn't.
Yep.
So we're also forgetting that about 25% of this country is Republican, 25% is Democrat, and the rest of us are up for grabs. If a different person, like if there was a somebody else on the ballot, somebody else would have won in a landslide. And so what we're also seeing is a rejection of these two parties that are so corrupt to their core that I do think that this could lead to something new. This could lead to, you know, Jill Stein and Gary Johnson were not exactly inspiring candidates. But if in the next 4 years we found someone as independents and said, okay, we're backing you, you know, there's 50% of us that are still sitting on the sidelines. So I also have hope in this untapped voting block that could easily change the world. And maybe this is the wake-up call. I hope so. I don't know what else it's going to take. But 25% of this country just elected Donald Trump. The other 75, we got to get our act together.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine if like Noam Chomsky was the third party candidate, you know, or like some of these individuals that we know have, you know, these intellectuals who have more like green policy. I just think that Jill Stein was the absolute wrong Green Party representative this go around. This would have been a chance for a third party candidate that actually had chops. You know, if Nader had run again, for example, I think that they probably, I don't know if there would have been even a chance of winning, but probably would have gotten a bigger chunk of the electorate than ever in the past. Because this was a tough decision for a lot of people. A lot of people stayed home. And it really didn't help. I know that there's a lot of argumentation right now about the media's role in this. But I really don't think it helped that the media as a whole just kind of took a Clinton win for granted and didn't really think to stop and listen to the people who actually were planning on voting for Trump all along. They sort of just discounted them as being like yokels and as kind of not really having a great great effect or impact on the election. And that was a very dangerous decision that was sort of made across the board.
It was, but when I think about the numbers, the fact that the Republicans, they didn't show up for Trump. That's not the story here. It's that they didn't show up for Clinton because the numbers were flat. It was the same people that have been voting Republican forever. I mean, there's a team mentality with the Republicans that the Democrats just don't have. But there are people that are like, my daddy's a Republican. My granddaddy's a Republican. I'm a Republican. I always vote Republican. That's a real thing. And so, but the Clinton factor, they so purposefully ignored all of the downsides. And through the WikiLeaks emails, we learned about the collusion, you know? And I know there's collusion between like Fox News and the Republicans, but I think that's what really got exposed here. I think during the Bush years, we saw that Fox News was colluding with Republicans. In this election, we saw that MSNBC and CNN, and they are colluding with the Democratic Party. We have a problem with these two big parties and the media working together for predetermined outcomes. And unfortunately, I think this is great. What's great is that us voters, we still really do get a say, because if it was up to these people, then Hillary would have been the nominee. This is proof to me that our system actually does still work because our votes determined it, not them.
Yeah. And I think that I'm hoping just that this this big sort of surprise, this big upset is going to motivate people in a way that maybe they hadn't been previously. You know, people who are, for example, environmentalists, people who champion science and scientific thought, they feel like they took a big beating right now. And I think mm-hmm. if anything, it's just going to inspire them, or I should say us, to continue to work and know that we're just going to keep doing what we've always been doing. Not that much has really changed in the grand scheme of things, but there just might be a little bit more importance behind it. My biggest fear is that the complacent become more complacent because they feel like, what's the point? The unfortunate thing is, like, you kind of want to shake them by the shoulders and say, no, this is what happens when you don't vote.
Yeah. Well, you know? Kind of along those same lines, I'm hoping that the people who are involved get a bit more strategic about it on the congressional side. Mm-hmm. The Republicans have been doing this for a long time and have been ignoring Congress. Like, one of the things that's been making me sad is as I look at the very dramatic Facebook posts from the people in my life,
yes.
none of them are mentioning the fact that the House and Senate are Republican. It's all about Trump and Hillary still. Yep. And so when I look at the next 4 years, how do we deal with this? What do we do?
And how do we make sure that they come out in 2 years because there's no president on the ticket?
Well, that's the thing, because that's our next chance to change this or rectify a situation we're all upset about. It's Congress in 2018. And I don't think that there's ever been a moment, at least since I've been doing Congressional Dish, where Congress has ever been more important and been an actual tool that we can use to stop something that we feel like might be really bad. So I'm hoping there's an awakening towards our own branch, because Kara, one of the things that blows me away is we all seem to hate Congress. They've had like a 9% approval rating. Yeah. 21 states didn't fire a single congressman. 21 states have the same exact people coming back that served in the 114th Congress. And then on top of that, we have 6 states that just filled vacancies. So over half of the states did nothing.
Yeah, and like, and don't they say the number one predictor of getting elected to Congress is that you're already serving in Congress?
Like, yeah.
Why is it that we just keep rehiring these people when like you said, 9% approval rating? In any other career, in any other institution, if you were like, yeah, I am 91% against this person, you would probably work to get them out.
Yeah, I think it's a stunning lack of awareness. And I think we have a ballot. I don't think we have a ballot access problem, because I did an episode because I was curious. I wanted to know, as someone who's not a Democrat or Republican, is it possible to get on the ballot for the House in all 50 states? The answer was yes. It's dramatically different based on which state you're in. But yes, it is possible in all 50 states. Some are more expensive. Some require more signatures. Fine. But we can do it. The difference is no one is doing it. There is no strategy. No one talks about Congress. I know that I had a room full of people here who are friends with me. You know I'm Congress obnoxious. And none of them knew who their Congress people were until Tuesday morning.
Yeah.
So I'm guilty of this too. The propositions, I hadn't read any of them until Tuesday morning. But we're not focusing on Congress for 2 whole years the way we are with the presidential race. And we really have to flip that. And I'm hoping where 2018 is our next hope to deal with a president that I think people on both sides of the aisle are like, oh my God, how did this happen? I'm hoping that the word gets out that we have this opportunity to strategically replace people in Congress and do something about this situation. So I'm overwhelmed because I feel like I'm one of like 3 people that's saying this, but I'm very optimistic by the number of communications I've had in the last few days of people being like, okay, 2018, you know, like it's occurring to some people and they're reaching out to me and being like, 2018, how do we do it? What are our steps? And people are already thinking along those lines. And I don't know if it's because I'm in the bubble of my own congressional world here, but I'm hopeful for that. It could help.
Well, it's such a tight difference right now, especially in the Senate, right? 51 Republicans, yeah. 48 Democrats, and one independent, I would assume, who probably sways more liberal. So that's like very easy to overcome. That is not insurmountable. And even in the House, 239 Republicans, 192 Democrats, it's not a big difference. Like,
well, I
at
put
all.
most of my faith in the House, because the Senate, we can only replace a third of them every year. When you look at who's up, we have a lot of red people. Like, I don't know, like the next 2018 is going to be tough in the Senate if people aren't paying attention in the way that I hope they will. But the House gives me so much hope because every one of them can be replaced every 2 years. And so we really can make a huge difference in all budget things. All money arrangements have to start in the House. The House has an extraordinary amount of power. And it was designed that way because the House was supposed to be ours. We were supposed to be able to clean House when we needed to. And I've never seen a more important moment to do that than 2018. Because here's the thing. I know what we're in for. Knowing exactly who these people are, I know what bills they're passing. I know exactly what we're in for. I've been studying these people for 4 years.
Yeah.
So I don't have a lot of hope that their bills won't be fossil fuel friendly and privatizing everything. And, you know, I am concerned about the legislation. So
but that's also often a Democratic agenda. Like, there's nothing super Republican about being, you know, cozy with the fossil fuel industries.
That's
like,
true.
When we talk about trying to kind of divorce ourselves from that, we're actually more talking about a progressive liberal agenda than a Democratic versus Republican agenda, because the truth of the matter is that most of these individuals are centrist. We did have a big wave, like a scary wave of Tea Party individuals who made their way into Congress over the last kind of like two elections. But the vast majority of them are pretty moderate, which means they kind of have a longstanding history of being cozy with the fossil fuel industries. I mean, Clinton was cozy with the fossil fuel industries.
Well, and the banks.
And the banks.
The banks have
a
lot of sway. Yeah, that's over true. Both parties. And so
I would love to see more independence. You know, the fact that we only have one independent in the Senate is kind of worrisome. But you know what? Do you think that it's sort of, I don't know, like a marketing issue, a perception issue? When we think about why the presidential election is so exciting to people and why there's name recognition and everybody gets out, even though the numbers are actually pretty abysmal, but much more than for the midterms. Do you think it's really just because they know the names? It's Clinton versus Trump, and we know who those two people are, and we've been reading about them, and it just gets kind of murky and confusing once you're like, no, but it's my representative. I don't know who that is, and I don't know what they represent. Like, how do we improve kind of public understanding of these individuals? Is it about the speaker? Is it about being like, let's get rid of this speaker and let's get a new speaker of the House in? I mean, how do we target it and give it a human face?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. That's what's keeping me awake at night these last 3 days, because the media, if you think about what the television media has to do, they have to appeal to the whole country, where all of this is local. So, you know, you're not going to have a really in-depth discussion of the people in Congress because there's 435 districts in the House of Representatives. It's too local to make an interesting story. There's too many people. Where Trump and Hillary, they're on everybody's ballot. And so I think that's a big part of it. I think it's just, if people are getting their news from the television, it's just tough to make it on a national scale. And so, I mean, the only way that I can think of to combat it is to do my podcast. Like, that's, and I'm hoping more people will do stuff like this, because I'm overwhelmed in the number of committees that I need to watch. And I'm thinking of switching from, I obviously have to read the bills that become law, because there's going to be a lot more of them, but there's a lot that goes on in the hearings where you can get to know these people as people. Like, that's how I know why people feel the way they do, is because I'm watching the hearings. So I'm thinking about shifting my show to more of a hearing thing, where I take a 4-hour hearing, make it an hour, and kind of give people the context behind it. But I feel like independent media is going to have to find a way to make Congress accessible and interesting, because right now, aside, and I'm not saying this to pitch my show, but honestly, like, I don't know where else to find this information except for what I'm doing.
Yeah, unless you just want to watch C-SPAN all day.
Yeah, and it's really hard to do. I mean, I don't love watching 6-hour hearings. Just staying awake in them is a challenge for me. And there's a lot of information to get through, but someone's got to do it, and I need help, you know? So I'm hoping that there are more people that will turn their attention to Congress and share information in whatever way is most creative and effective for them. But I do struggle with that question, Kara. I don't know what aside from what I'm doing, I don't know how we do this. I don't know how we get a media that is so obsessed with the presidential election to pay attention to anything else. I don't think that we can change them. The only thing we can do is stop watching them and watch something else.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe start supporting more independent media, like you said, like your podcast, like some of these news organizations. You know, I did a lot of work with the Young Turks. I don't get paid by them anymore because I haven't been on in ages. And even when I do go on, I make very little money. So, like, I'm saying this just purely because I believe in independent media, and I think that we should support it. You know, a lot of these different groups have Patreons. That's part of my model for Talk Nerdy. I have a Patreon page. You go there. You don't have to support it because it's free, but we can exist because people do support it. And that's where we can kind of vote with our dollar. You know, we can't really control what's on the dial ultimately, except by boycotting it. You know, shows don't last if people don't watch them. Like, it's a pretty cutthroat world in traditional media, and so we can kind of fight back by supporting independent media. That's a great way to do it. But, you know, there is some onus on just kind of educating ourselves, and I'm guilty of it too. Like you said, you're guilty of it, I'm guilty of it. It's hard. It's a lot to keep up with, and a lot of people just disengage with politics. They're like, oh, I'm not political. That really is problematic for me, because it's like kind of the basic thing that you need to do to be a citizen. I personally think I'm one of these people who doesn't just advocate for changing the voting day away from Tuesday or making it a national holiday. I actually advocate for mandated voting. Mm-hmm. That's just, I appreciate it in countries like Australia where you legally have to go to the polls. I think that's just the same way that you legally have to pay your taxes. Yeah. I don't see why we do one and not the other. It's a way to support democracy in our country. And I think it's crazy that we can just, you know, choose to stay home, because ultimately you are running the risk of having what we have now, which is more of a plutocracy or an oligarchy instead of a traditional democracy. Because if not everybody's participating, then who is? The people with interests.
Apparently Trump supporters.
Yeah, exactly. And individuals with interests. You know, there's a lot of things we can change with campaign finance reform. There's a lot of work to be done. But I didn't know what to expect when I had you on the show, because we've sort of talked a little like on Twitter, but we haven't really had a full on conversation about it. I am really appreciating your positive outlook and your kind of, guys, it's, you know, let's wait until January 20th and see. Like, it's not, he's not even our president yet. He's our president-elect. We don't know. Yeah. What to expect. There's no reason to run around screaming. And I'm honestly incredibly disappointed in my fellow progressives and some of the not so peaceful protests that are happening throughout the country right now. It looks bad. And we've got to stop and remember, this is the way that we're feeling right now is exactly how a lot of the people who voted for Trump felt when Obama was elected.
Yeah.
We can talk about the morals of why we voted, and we can point fingers and do all of that, but like, we're in the same camp that they were in. Like, we should try and be a little bit empathetic.
Well, and there's so much meanness towards it, where it's like, if you voted for Trump, you're a racist, misogynist. Like, I don't think that that's true. We don't know why people voted the way they did. Everybody has their reasons.
Yeah, I don't think it's the vast majority. I think it's a very pernicious minority. And I think it's a little unfair to paint it with a broad brush.
Yeah, there's just a lot of finger pointing and blaming. And the thing is that we do have some control over this. I mean, one thing that I've learned, I'm kind of excited. I'm going to Mexico, and I have decided to come back. But
yeah, I'm going to Mexico.
I'm leaving for 9 days next week just because I knew I'd need a break. I'm totally burned out.
Yeah.
And so in my absence, I have an interview that I've been sitting on for months with the chief of staff of a Republican congressman. And I'm super excited to give people this information, because one of the things that I learned, not only from this interview with the Chip Lake is his name, with the chief of staff, but also from Jack Abramoff, one of the most powerful lobbyists until he was too good and ended up in jail. Mm-hmm. Both of them told me in no uncertain terms that when we call and email and show up at our congressmen's offices, especially in the House of Representatives, they care because we vote every 2 years. And so if we want to direct our Congress in how we want them to deal with Trump, we have the power to do that. We need to participate in our own system. And this could be a wake-up call.
And we've got to remember that these people, like, honestly, what do they care about more than anything else? getting reelected. So they really are beholden to their constituency. I think we forget about that a lot. The night of the election, I have a friend who's a hardcore environmental activist who is texting me very upset and was like, I need to talk to somebody who's rational. I'm losing hope. What do I do? What do I do? Like full on, I want to flee to Canada stuff. And I was like, okay, that's not productive. It's not whatever. And at one point, I'm going to read a little text that I posted it on social media that I was saying, I was just like a wall of text where it was like, the will of the people is more powerful than any single president. If we put solar on our houses, we need less coal. If we drive electric, we use less petroleum. The president can't fuck with that. Let's make fossil fuel irrelevant. Let's reduce emissions. We're already moving in that direction. Let's make it so ExxonMobil doesn't have a profit to turn and their government subsidies don't matter because people don't want their product. It's happening. It's not happening fast enough, but it's happening. And that's something we have to always remember. We can undermine all of this with decisions that we make at the personal level. Sometimes I think we forget and we think the president controls everything. The president actually controls very little. Congress controls more, but even the Congress is in our pockets as individual people because they will not do things if they think it will cost them reelection. They won't.
Absolutely.
They're so scared of not getting reelected. And so we can really pull their strings in that way. They were elected to represent us. We need to make sure that they do that.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, they're most afraid of the voters, but they are also trying to appeal to their donors. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a big part of the pushback, too, is to be like, listen, I am not giving you thousands of dollars, but you're spending that money to earn my vote. And we have to realize the power of that. They're collecting the money to buy the ads to earn your vote. Your vote is the most important thing to these people. And so that's why the strategy of contacting them works. You don't need to fund them. You need to tell them what you want them to do.
Yeah, because the sweetest revenge is if they get so much money from the Koch brothers and then they run with all these attack ads and then they still lose because we don't trust them or we don't believe them or they failed us in some way.
Well, that's what just happened to the Clintons.
It's true. Exactly. And that's the power of going to the polls. That's so important. So you know what? We've been talking a lot about these like top line things. Obviously, this is a very America-centric episode. It makes sense. I think the whole world is actually looking at the election right now. I would like to actually get a little more centric. We both live in California. There were referenda across the nation. A lot of people voted for a lot of cool stuff, and we saw some really interesting outcomes. Weirdly, even though we saw a very conservative House and Senate and executive, we actually saw a lot of very progressive sort of propositions and ordinances being passed across the board. Here in California, we're a very progressive state. Obviously, we voted for Clinton by a landslide. But we also voted for a lot of cool stuff in our propositions. One thing disappointed me, though, we did not overturn the death penalty.
I know.
That was surprising. What is that about? That's a huge surprise.
You know, I get upset when I haven't seen them yet, but I just have the suspicion it's still happening, that young people still aren't voting.
Yeah.
And the baby boomers in my life, they believe in capital punishment. They believe in, it's almost like they don't look at the numbers and realize that it's more expensive to go through the legal battles of putting someone to death. And, you know, it's expensive to have people on death row, but they think, I don't want to pay for them forever in jail. We should just kill them.
Yeah, and it is more expensive. And I think that there is sort of a holdover religiosity to that. That's a very biblical viewpoint of an eye for an eye. And also, I don't know if we've done a good enough job of educating the public about times when, unfortunately, we put somebody to death that was later found innocent. You know, the hit rate is not amazing. And so, to me, it's just obviously my personal politics are that it's a massive civil rights violation, that it's incredibly immoral, and it's kind of there's no question as to why we need to overturn the death penalty. But you're right. A lot of people, even progressives that are in this older set, they've lived with the death penalties for so long. It just seems like it's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I don't know how to reach the younger generation. I'm super frustrated. I don't know what we do about that, honestly. I mean,
especially because, like, marijuana was on the ballot. Like, obviously, they came out to vote for that.
Yeah.
It's super weird. It's super weird. Or maybe young people, by and large, are split on the death penalty issue. Maybe it's just an assumption that if you're somewhat progressive, you're also against the death penalty. Maybe that's not true.
I mean, I think the bigger problem we're going to see is that the young people just didn't vote. Yeah. We keep seeing it, that the older generation votes and the younger generation isn't. I've seen a lot of hashtag do not vote on Twitter, which is really frustrating. God. A lot of people that are very aware of the details and the problems in this country saying, like, I don't want to participate in a corrupt system. I don't know what we do about that stupidity.
Or even the ones who do going about it in sort of a flippant, cynical way. I had a fan tweet at me and I retweeted it and I was very kind to this person because although it is flattering, I was incredibly disheartened by the fact that they said, I wrote you in for my presidential vote. And I'm like, no, like that a protest vote is not a vote.
Yeah.
It's I mean,
I believe in voting for people that are on your ballot.
Yes.
You know, like, I resent the fact that people call my Jill Stein vote a protest vote because
she was on the ballot. That's true.
She was on the ballot. She could get to 270 if we actually supported her with our votes. It was possible. Same for Gary Johnson, mm-hmm. Hillary and Trump. We had four choices. But like to just write in a name,
it's one thing if it's somebody who's not on the ballot but who you know is running. It's another thing to just write in a name who's not running for president.
Yeah,
it's like it frustrates me. But so people did come out though. You know, the numbers might not have been what we wanted, and it may not have been as many young people as we had hoped. But maybe that's a good sign because it's showing that the boomers and the older voters are for more progressive legislation here in California. Single-use plastic and paper bags were banned outright. That's something we've had in Los Angeles for quite a while. I think you've had it in San Francisco as well. But now we see it across the state. That's awesome. We're seeing that marijuana by adults 21 and over, legal. Just straight legal. Just for recreation, for whatever. This is a huge step forward in the war on drugs. Decriminalizing. I mean, this is a very libertarian thing, but I mean 56% said yes. It's funny how it's always so tight though. Isn't it funny how almost any issue you can think of, it's always going to be 50 something to 40 something?
Yeah, it's so weird.
It's so weird. There's never that big a margin. Let me see. There are some things that had, look at this. Extending the existing fee on hospitals to fund coverage for Medi-Cal, uninsured patients, and children's health. 70% voted yes. Yep. So we at least see that healthcare is of utmost importance here in California and that we're willing to pay for it. And I think that's important. And we see a few more that are 60-some-odd percent. Stopping the legislator from passing any bill unless it's published on the internet for 72 hours. I know some people had some issues with that, but I do think it's good to always push for more transparency.
I love that one so much because the other part that no one's talking about is all of the hearings are going to be put on the internet.
Which so is so great. Possible. It's democratizing access.
Absolutely. And it allows for a California dish to exist now because I've looked like, and we need it on our state level. So I'm hoping that this happens more and more in other states so we can be aware on our state government too.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very cool. We increased taxes on tobacco and e-cigarettes to help fund health care for low income Californians. That was by a big margin.
What was that one? What was the result on that one?
That was 63% yes. Nice. Another one of our biggest margins, actually, Proposition 58, allowing schools to establish non-English-only education programs, 72% yes. That Love feels that. Like a direct response to a Trump run. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a very pro-immigration stance, and I think that's really, really cool. And then some other high-up ones. were background checks for purchasing ammunition, prohibiting possession of large capacity magazines, allowing parole consideration for nonviolent felons, and allowing juvenile court judges to decide whether juveniles will be prosecuted as adults, and extending income tax on earnings over $250,000 to fund schools and healthcare. All of those were within a 60-some-odd percent yes vote. So that's really cool. I think that we sometimes lose faith, but we have to remember that a lot of our local politics and local government has the most effect on how we live our lives in the day-to-day. And it's cool to see in the communities where people came out and where people did their civic duty, that their voice was heard. And a lot of this stuff is going to affect us much more blatantly than the presidential or even the House and the Senate. So we've
and
got
I'm glad that you brought up like the state level stuff, because we also have to remember that the state is a way to push back on the federal government too.
Absolutely.
So like, energy is a great example here. My husband is a solar power engineer, and he's not worried about this because California has such great goals as far as renewable energy is concerned. And there's so many states now that have adopted renewable energy mandates that he's not that worried about the fossil fuel favors that are going to come federally, because solar is getting cheaper and more of us are adopting it, like you said, voluntarily. Mm-hmm. You know, these people that we've elected to the federal government, they believe in the free market. And so if we're voting with our wallets, that's going to reach them. So we're not powerless. We're really not.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Now, Jen, there's obviously so much we could continue to talk about. I would love to check back in with you after the inauguration, or maybe even 6 months down the road, so we can see kind of where things stand. But in the meantime, you've been on the show before. I can't remember, but did I ask you to answer those final two questions that I ask everybody on the show?
Well, I've been on the show twice, so I'm sure at some point.
Holy crap, you've been on twice already?
Yeah, we did one Skype, and then we did the one at your house.
I think, you know what, I was confused by that because I remember hanging with you in person and doing the one in the house. And obviously that was probably the most fresh in my mind. But when I logged onto Skype and I was like, what's your Skype ID again? And I put it in. We had a whole like history.
Yeah.
So that makes sense now.
That's what reminded me too. So don't feel bad.
That is so funny. Okay. Well, either way, I'm going to ask you those same two questions again, only because so much has happened recently, and I would love to get to the core of where your head is at here in these days after the election. So if you don't remember, they are, when you look to the future, what is the thing that worries you the most and that you're, you know, kind of the most concerned about? And on the flip side of that, what are you the most excited, optimistic, and hopeful for?
You know, they're related. One of the things I'm most worried about is that we've given too much power to the executive branch since the W. Bush administration. I'm worried about the NSA and the CIA drones and just the power that we've given to the executive. Mm-hmm. But the thing that gives me the most hope is that maybe this is an opportunity for us to discover our own power in Congress and put that power back where it belongs, in the people's branch. I mean, every bad thing is an opportunity to fix a problem. And it's, you know, we were worried in the George W. Bush administration when that power was transferred. And I feel like we kind of relaxed when it was Obama because we trusted him. And now the problem is being exposed again. So maybe now we'll fix it. And so that actually gives me some hope, because I think there's a good chance that pendulum will start to swing back.
That's such a great answer, especially considering everything that's going on right now in American politics. And guys, if you are listening from the United States, I really urge you to check out Jen's podcast. But even if you are outside of the U.S., especially probably our biggest listenership is in England, Australia, Ireland, and Canada, but we even have listeners, you know, in places where English is not the dominant language. A lot of people are interested in American government, American politics, and you don't get the nuance in kind of the national media that you might get. So all of you who are interested in civics and you know, individual control over policy, I urge you to check out Jen's podcast, Congressional Dish. Why don't you tell them sort of, you know, what the frequency is, where they can find it, all that good stuff?
Well, right now I'm doing it twice a month, every the second and fourth Sundays. But for this next administration, I'm going to try and do more. Yeah, right now I'm doing as much as I can. I'm going to try and do weekly. I need to hire some people. But yeah, right now you can count on twice a month, and I'm going to do as much as I possibly can to give you awareness as what's going on in the United States. So,
and I know you won't say it because it's hard to ask for money, but do you have a Patreon page?
I just started a Patreon page, so I do. And nice. I'm taking your advice. You actually talked me into it, because Patreon allows people to contribute per episode. Mm-hmm. And so I have people contributing on Patreon per episode, PayPal monthly, and I have a bunch of people sending in physical checks. And then I also have an Amazon search box. But my podcast is fully listener supported. And that way there's no company that can tell me not to tell you anything. So
Yeah. But and yes. So, guys, you can listen for free. That's the great thing. But if you want to support the show, you're going to be able to help Jen do exactly what she said, which is hire more individuals, be able to move to a weekly format and just keep you informed more frequently and with more focus. So definitely, if you're looking to support, this is a great way to support independent media. I absolutely recommend you check it out. And you have a website too, right?
I do, congressionaldish.com. Oh, and I should probably mention that, you know, you don't know me, not you, Kara, but like the people who are listening. Like, I don't expect people to trust what I say. And so I put an enormous amount of time and effort into my show notes. So like when I read a bill, I not only link to the bill, but I link to provisions in the bill that I'm talking about. I give you all my sources because I believe strongly in giving you the power to check my work and also do your own research. And so congressionaldish.com is where you find all of my resources.
Oh, see, now I need to take your advice because my show notes are abysmal, but that's something that I think Patreon support could really help with because I'm a one-man band. I know you have been for quite a while, but you're talking about getting some support and some help, and you're kind of moving in that direction. It's really hard when it's just you. It's like all in... encompassing, yeah. Especially when you have a day job, you know? Yeah. So, guys, thank you so much. Jen, thank you for joining me this week. I feel much more informed and actually like I'm breathing a little deeper. I'm a little more hopeful for the future.
Good. I'm feeling better too. I'm glad we did this.
Yeah, absolutely. And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.